This is Only a Game. I'm Jason Gay. Cleveland Cavaliers fans, they tasted some sweet success when LeBron James led them to win the 2016 NBA title, breaking a championship drought in James's home state of Ohio. But when LeBron bailed for Los Angeles last offseason, Cavaliers fans found themselves desperate for any nuggets of happiness. I mean this literally. Allison Poley has the story.
3.5 months into the season, the Cleveland Cavaliers were on a hot two-game win streak, which brought their grand total of wins to 11. The Cavs had the second-worst record in the Eastern Conference. Many key players were sidelined. Things were bleak. But on February 2nd, the team had been holding its own against the Dallas Mavericks. Fans had reason to hope the Cavs might win 3 games in a row for the first time all season. Kyle Molinelli is a lifelong Cavs fan who was at the game.
We started, what seems to be a theme with us, is that either we make it close in the fourth quarter and never finish the job, or we just fall off completely in the fourth quarter. And that was one of those games where we just fell off. We couldn't find the basket to save our lives.
For much of the fourth quarter, Dallas maintained a 10-point lead. And as hope of a Cavs victory slipped away, Molinelli remembers the fans around him chanting,
"Chicken nuggets! Chicken nuggets!"
Chicken nuggets isn't a player's nickname. The crowd was quite literally cheering for nuggets, as in chicken McNuggets. You know, the ones you get from McDonald's. When the Cavaliers score 100 points in a home game, fans get a free 10-piece McNuggets, win or lose. Kim Fletcher, another lifelong Cavs fan and current season ticket holder, was at the game with her daughter.
They had 98 points. Elise looks over and she goes, "Mom, we're so close to nuggets." I'm like, "I know, right?"
The Mavericks had possession of the ball with 8 seconds left. The score was 111-98. Cavs center Ante Zizic stole the ball and passed it to his teammate, Dang Adele, who dribbled up the court. The chant continued.
I think that resonated with the team, actually, because I feel like they're starting to get more hustle on the floor.
Fans stood up, their arms raised over their heads, eyes glued to the ball. In Fletcher's section, fans were chanting,
"Nuggets, nuggets, nuggets."
Dang Adele desperately heaved the ball to another teammate, Jaron Blossom Game, who was racing toward the basket.
Blossom Game, yeah.
Matt Eck and Adam Hines, who work for the Cavs' in-house game presentation team, watched Blossom Game from their perches in the control room and on the court.
You could tell as soon as he started coming down the court that he was going to try to do it. And, of course, all of us in the control room are like, we're cheering for Nuggets, too.
He went for it, which was great. The crowd absolutely went nuts.
Crowd wants 100 points.
Blossom Game put up a shot just before time ran out. Molinelli watched the ball rise toward the basket.
The whole arena was silent for a split second.
Maybe this all sounds like the setup to another joke about Cleveland, about fans so starved for a win they'll cheer for literally anything, including a 10-piece chicken nugget giveaway valued at about $3.65. But when a team rebuilds, some fans find that things they might have taken for granted before suddenly take on a new significance. Now, this is a good time for a disclaimer. I'm a die-hard Cleveland fan, and I think I speak for my fellow Clevelanders when I say we have developed a taste for McDonald's chicken nuggets. And with the Cavs right there among the best teams in the NBA over the past few years, Cleveland fans got free nuggets at about 80% of home games. Sure, plenty of other teams have their own giveaways, but in Cleveland, nuggets are a spectacle. Here's Matt Eck again. He directs videos for the Cavs' nearly 60-foot-long Jumbotron.
We have a countdown to nuggets, so it starts at 10 and 9 and so forth all the way to 1.
Cavs score 100, and all of a sudden, little chicken nuggets just come floating down on the Jumbotron, and they will shower for about 30 seconds.
I've never measured the size of the nuggets, but they're probably 5 to 10 feet tall each. You got these huge chunks of meat just raining down.
Cavs fans have gotten pretty serious about those raining chunks of meat. Even Ahmad Crump, the in-arena MC for the Cavs, is a nugget enthusiast.
Yeah, Ahmad is super into it. He loves it. He loves McDonald's too.
He'll go and find a ticket after everyone's left, and he gets McDonald's on the way home. And I was like, really? You go after every time? He's like, oh boy, yeah, yep.
But fans didn't make as many trips to redeem Nuggets this season. Without LeBron James in Cleveland, and with a slew of injuries taking out many of the team's starters, the Cavs struggled. They only won 19 games. Cavs fans got Nuggets at just 63% of their home games. And, unlike in years past, most of those Nuggets didn't come as chasers after a win. This season, half of the Nuggets giveaways came during losses.
I think the Nuggets represent maybe a little bit of the old Cavs mixed in with the new Cavs. The Nuggets represent those days where we were getting them at almost every home game. And when we do get the Nuggets, we're appreciative of the Nuggets because they worked to 100 points. So it's almost like a peek into the future. Like, oh my gosh, they are scoring. They are working their offensive plans together. We can do this.
As we develop this young team, as we develop the young core and hopefully find winning basketball in the future, the Nuggets are kind of like a beacon of hope.
Now, Cavs fans are nothing if not loyal. They came in eighth in NBA attendance this year. So that's why, on that February 2nd night, with the Cavs down 111-98, the crowd cheered. They weren't ready to give up.
Chicken Nuggets. Chicken Nuggets.
Nuggets, Nuggets, Nuggets.
They wanted that feeling of a win, and Jerron Blossom Game looked like he was going to give it to them. Just before the clock hit zero, Blossom Game put up the shot.
It's up on the rim, and the buzzer sounds, and there's a collective.
So no Nuggets, and no win tonight on this Saturday night in front of a very good crowd. As the Cavaliers fall 111-98.
There's more than one victory in a game. There's the shot that goes in when it wasn't supposed to. There's the free T-shirt that comes sailing into your hands. These micro-victories add up to the full game experience. And for Cleveland fans, 10 free McDonald's chicken nuggets have become another micro-victory, a way to experience something that feels bigger than themselves.
I think it's goofy and fun. And the city of Cleveland, we get made fun of all the time. And I think the Nuggets are just us being Clevelanders. We just love to celebrate the littlest of things and the biggest of things. You've got to have a lot of passion to be a Cleveland sports fan, a lot of patience to be a Cleveland sports fan, and a lot of perseverance. But we always are rewarded with nuggets of brilliance, no pun intended.
That story came from WBUR's Allison Poley. The Cavs played their last regular season game at home on April 9th. They only scored 97 points in a blowout loss to the Hornets. But don't worry, the fans got their nuggets anyway. It was Fan Appreciation Night. It's time for three stories you should know. The NFL draft began Thursday in Nashville, Tennessee. Commissioner Roger Goodell was there. Number one pick Kyler Murray was there. And
Taylor Swift is here, live on ABC. Look at Taylor! Woo! You wouldn't miss this party.
No.
We don't have Taylor Swift on this segment, but we're going to shake it off. Because we do have Sports Illustrated's Charlotte Wilder. Welcome, Charlotte.
Thank you. Happy to be here, Jason.
Congratulations on your hit singles. And also with us, the Ringer's Katie Baker. Welcome, Katie.
Hi, Jason. How are you?
Terrible. No, I'm great. I want to get to my topic first because, well, I'm just alarmed. I don't want to sound too freaked out, but the heck with it. Gang, I think the NFL draft has lost its mind. Did you watch any of the first round on Thursday? The hype has reached spectacular levels. It's like the Oscars meets the VMAs meets a Mike Ditka acid trip. I don't know if it was Nashville, the rowdy crowd, or yes, Taylor Swift hyping a new single that would release at midnight. I don't know if it was all those emotions and tears and hugs. Is it too much to ask for a decaf draft? Charlotte?
At this point, yeah. It's way too much to ask. The NFL, Jason, the NFL's business model is snaking its tentacles into the pockets of Americans every way they can. And the draft is just one more example of that, where it's like, hey, you can come with your buddies and cheer on the owners of your favorite team and then, you know, watch some poor guy get stuck with Giants tickets for life, which, whoo.
Katie, you are no stranger to watching the NHL draft, so I imagine football just as bizarre a world to you.
Well, first of all, I resent, as a Giants fan, having to acknowledge that the draft even took place at all.
Oh, sorry, gosh. Katie. Sorry, yeah. Katie.
But yeah. When you talk about a decaf draft, I really can't think of a better example than the NHL, because what the NHL draft does offer you is, instead of all the war rooms, they actually have all the executives sitting around tables down on the arena floor and all the fans sitting around. So it's like people watching like the world's most terrible wedding reception.
Katie, I have a technical question to ask you. Have the boos for Roger Goodell reached the Gary Bettman level?
It'll never be the same, because Bettman's response to the boos is so kind of masterful and like evil genius. Bettman will actually kind of mess with the crowd and say, you know, I think you're going to want to stop booing, because you're going to want to hear this trade, and then announce a trade that, you know, tanks their organization. And Goodell doesn't have that chip. He's just kind of boring about it.
I think Goodell is very self-conscious about the booing. In fact, took the step in the first round of walking onto the stage with Tennessee Titans current quarterback Marcus Mariota, which was like self-defense, I believe.
Well, he always does this, Jason. He finds different ways to protect himself every year. Like, he either has someone with like a sob story that is so touching that he thinks that if you boo it, you'll be a jerk, but yeah. No, it never stops anyone anyway.
He has a human boo shield that is just the lowest of the low.
I need a boo shield. All right, Katie, you're up on this show. What do you got?
Vladimir Guerrero Jr. is the recently turned 20-year-old son of former Montreal Expo and Los Angeles Angel and Hall of Fame outfielder Vladimir Guerrero. Vladdy Jr. is one of the most exciting prospects that's come along in a really long time. In 2015, as a 16-year-old, Vladdy Jr. signed a $3.9 million international prospect contract with the Toronto Blue Jays, and at long last, he finally got the call up to the major leagues this past week, following almost a year's worth of a lot of huge home runs in minor league parks and a lot of discussion in the baseball world about contractual loopholes and forced baseball labor. You probably have seen some of his highlights on Twitter, because he's an extremely viral content generator. So it's going to be the exciting start of hopefully, you know, someone who can actually bring a lot of good attention to the sport.
Charlotte, you're a millennial who watches baseball.
Mm-hmm.
Are you pumped?
I'm so psyched for several reasons. First of all, I think it's really, here's the oldest narrative in myths, in battles, in sports. It's the father and the son. Really, it hits all the spots that you want a sports narrative to hit. Like, you can't make a movie about this without being told you're being too saccharine. And I'm excited, too, because I think that what MLB has been really trying to push, and I actually talked to their head of marketing about this, is the whole let the kids play, allowing the bat flips, letting guys talk. And I think that's still a bit of a struggle, because I don't think that they necessarily have a ton of guys with that charisma. Like, you've got Bregman. Yeah. I think Judge tries. I think Yelich is sort of trying too. But then you got Mike Trout, who just like loves the weather and his dog. So like, the more characters we can get in there, and if Vlad Jr. can sort of take up this mantle as being he's great at drawing a walk, he's great at hitting a home run. Those are the things that's sort of propelling baseball right now. So I can't wait to see what happens with this.
Are there like sort of Canadian vibes here too? I can't help but think the fact that he's playing for the Blue Jays. Now, they're not the Expos. I know they are very distinct cities and very distinct franchises, and one doesn't exist anymore. But is there something in the air about the fact that he is playing in Canada as his father began his career that is also contributing to the hype around this?
Yeah, I mean, he was born in Canada. So because the Expos aren't there, there is sort of a pan-Canadian cherished son aspect. Whereas, you know, if the Expos were still around, there might be a little bit more of a rivalry there.
I also feel like Canada could use something good right now after the NHL first round of playoffs, you know? Like, Canada's hurting a little bit right now. No offense, Canada.
I'm a truther for the theory that he was going to get called up on Tuesday, but there was the Game 7, so they delayed it.
Oh, yeah.
so that he could build off the momentum of a joyous win or distract all the fans for a while.
Charlotte, I understand you'd like to talk about a recent column that you read. I can't confirm, but I hear it's an early candidate for a Pulitzer or a Peabody.
Yeah, well, Jason, you recently wrote something about how the sports apocalypse is coming, which would be if Boston won championships in all four sports, which currently the city holds two. Bruins are still on the hunt for the Stanley Cup. Celtics are still trying to make it to the NBA Finals and win. You know, your argument, correct me if I'm wrong, was that this would be the worst thing for sports fans across the country, correct?
Yes. I think an asteroid crashing into the entirety of the United States would be just degrees less painful than Boston winning four consecutive championships.
Okay, hear me out. First of all, as a Boston fan, like I come to this completely biased. I think it would be fantastic. I think that there's no place I would rather be than in Boston when whichever team wins last, that happens. Like, I think the city might burn down, and I'm willing, if that's the way I go, that's the way I go. I also think, though, that there would never be a clearer enemy. And I think there would be something really wonderful to unite the rest of the country. It would just be like, we need to take the city down. I think this could be taken as like real fuel for all the other teams. And maybe they'd get better, because that's the only way you beat good teams is by getting better.
I feel they hate us because they ain't us is on the tip of your tongue. Do you want to
say it? I didn't say it. You said it.
Katie, your thoughts on the restrained Boston fan base and the possibility of a grand slam of Boston championships?
Well, just to bring this, you know, full circle to the New York Giants, the better the Patriots get, the funnier and more wonderful it is that the only team that they can't beat has Eli Manning as quarterback for the next 20 years. I always think about the fact that, has there been like a good magazine-length profile written on the poster kid, the kid that goes to all the parades with a big sign? I think it started when he was like actually a kid, and now it's like 16 years old, 11 parades.
It's 12, Katie, but yeah, fine.
I don't want to speak badly of another human, but now he's just the representative for everything that is bad about the city of Boston.
Yeah, there are kids who have, I believe, like tendonitis in their shoulders from applauding at so many duck boat parades. Like, you know, just chronic pain.
Well, Jason, you're from the area as well.
I am a self-loathing Boston sports fan. And the reason is, Charlotte, mm-hmm. is all this good stuff happened after I left. Mm. You got to bask in all the glory. I was gone. I'm resentful. I'm bitter. My Boston sports memories are mostly traumas. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I'm just a hater. I mean, I'm thrilled, of course. My mom's still there, and she's probably going to disown me when she hears this, but enough is enough.
First of all, I completely understand. I understand how insufferable Boston is. I sort of had a choice to make, I think, recently, where I was like, I can either feel guilty about all of these good things happening, or I can just really lean in and enjoy it. And I decided for once in my life not to punish myself. You know, I say, why not? Let's just go for it. Let's get all four.
My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been Sports Illustrated's Charlotte Wilder and The Ringer's Katie Baker. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you, Jason.
Thank you.
You're listening to Only a Game from NPR.
Support for Only a Game comes from Simon & Schuster, presenting this message. Simon & Schuster, publisher of Tiger Woods by Jeff Benedict and Armin Katayan. This New York Times best-selling biography of Tiger Woods is sourced from years of reporting and more than 250 interviews, chronicling the life and career of the championship golfer, including his childhood, rise to fame, and success on the golf course and business world, his public downfall, and ongoing comeback. Tiger Woods is available in paperback, ebook, and as an audiobook.
We know sometimes you need a break from all of the negativity, but there are so many good things all around us. Kind World is a show about profound acts of kindness that help transform lives. New episodes every Tuesday. Subscribe now on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Jason Gay. In 1959, St. Louis University won the first ever NCAA men's soccer championship. They also won six of the next 11 titles. Their team was known for being strong and physical, and their roster, all white.
So they just really dominated the sport.
Mark Wright worked for ESPN's The Undefeated. He loves soccer, and he's most interested in St. Louis's premier rival in the early 1970s, the historically black Howard University.
They had, you know, players from Africa and from the Caribbean, and they were coached by Lincoln Phillips, a Trinidadian who was young.
In 1971, St. Louis and Howard met in the national championship game. And what happened from there changed Mark's life and the lives of countless others. Here's Only a Game's Matthew Stock.
The cover art of the 1971 Howard University yearbook is a simple image of a black man raising his fist. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. had been assassinated less than 3 years earlier, and at Howard, the Black Power movement had taken center stage.
It really is stepping into a cauldron of civil rights.
Ian Bain grew up in Trinidad. His community there was mostly black. Newspapers and TV were his only real exposures to racism and the fight for civil rights. But in 1971, he moved to the United States and joined the Howard soccer team as a freshman midfielder.
Everything that we saw on our one channel in Trinidad and Tobago television was now unfolding right at our doorstep.
Opposing coaches would tell their players to shout racial slurs at Howard players to knock them off their game. Several players remember being called the N-word. But even still, Howard was really, really good.
When we took the field, it gave voice to people in a country that sometimes needed a voice.
On December 30th, nearly 6,000 spectators showed up at the Orange Bowl in Miami with the potential to witness history. If Howard beat St. Louis, it would become the first historically black college or university, or HBCU, to win an NCAA Division I national championship in any sport. Around this time, ESPN's Mark Wright was a young kid growing up in Jamaica and falling in love with soccer.
I remember getting a soccer ball for Christmas as one of my early gifts, and it was just, oh my gosh, it was the best thing ever. Instead of kicking juice boxes and putting newspaper in them and trying to make it a ball, I actually had a real ball, and that made me the coolest kid in the neighborhood.
Mark and his family moved to the U.S. on Mark's 12th birthday. He didn't meet Ian Bain until long after that 1971 championship game.
The first time I met him was in the lunchroom. He was one of the teachers on, you know, lunchroom security detail, I guess, you know, just kind of making sure that the kids didn't walk on tables or throw food at each other.
Mark was a student at Springbrook High School in Maryland. Ian Bain was a 35-year-old Spanish teacher and soccer coach.
He had pretty much the entire student body thinking that Coach Bain, Senor Bain is what everybody called him, was just the guy. This is pre-Google, right? I didn't know him from a can of paint that he was, you know, the football, the soccer legend that he was.
Mark's father was a welder. His mom was a nurse at the Howard University Hospital. And since money was tight, Mark got a job, too.
I worked at a dental office, everything from cleaning the equipment and making sure things are put away, taking out the garbage.
Mark worked from 5 to 7:30 every night, and this meant no soccer after school. But senior year, Mark quit his job and earned a spot on his high school team. And it didn't take long for him to realize that Coach Ian Bain was special.
He's big on showing you what he wants to do, right? So he'll put the ball down. And he'll say, look, I want you to kick it this way. And then he would demonstrate, we're teenage boys. We're not super smart, but we're easily impressed. And when a guy like that would demonstrate the way he did, it's like, wow, this guy is dope. And so whenever he said anything, we just kind of did it. If you did something nice, you did something impressive, you know, you would hear Coach Bain say, well, good boy, you're nice boy.
Coach Bain's opinion meant a lot to Mark. So when Mark decided to go to Howard University, he was encouraged to find out that his coach had gone there too.
It gave me a sense of, if Coach Bain had this experience that I'm about to embark on, and if he turned out the way he turned out, then there's a good chance that I'm, you know, things are probably going to end well for me.
And they did. A few years out of school, Mark got a job with ESPN the magazine. He bounced around in the industry and ended up back at ESPN a few years later. And then one day, in 2015...
I kid you not, a voice just said to me, Google Coach Bain. It had been probably 8 years to that point since we'd spoken.
An article came up about Coach Bain and some of his college teammates. They had just been inducted into the Howard Hall of Fame. Mark got Coach Bain's phone number.
When I talked to him, he said, yeah, it was really good. It was good to see the old guys again. By the way, Coach Lincoln just released his autobiography. We had some pretty good times, but you probably want to read the book if you want the full story. So I got Coach Lincoln's book, and after reading the book, I called Coach back and I said, Coach, this is an ESPN 30 for 30.
Mark got in touch with a friend from ESPN Films named Ken and Holly, and together they got approval to make a documentary short. But they were missing something.
We have no footage, no archived, no video, just grainy newspaper clippings. We had nothing.
Mark, Kennan, and their team interviewed Coach Phillips and about a dozen former Howard players. They generously let me use audio from those interviews in the piece you're listening to right now. So let's go back to December 30th, 1971. Howard's soccer team was set to take on St. Louis for the national championship game and a chance at history. Here's Ian Bain.
I think that game offered a platform. It was about sending messages and now embracing the role that we had.
Howard netted the go-ahead goal midway through the second half and held on to win 3-2.
I felt I would win 4 NCAA championships. After 71, I knew I was winning 3 more. There was no doubt in my mind.
It was an unbelievable moment.
That's Howard head coach Lincoln Phillips.
I was so proud and so happy. It brought tears. First one was tears of joy, and then one was tears of sorrow.
Tears of sorrow, because just 3 weeks later,
we heard that the NCAA going to sanction us, and they're going to take away the 71 championship from us.
The NCAA alleged that two of Howard's players hadn't taken the correct college entrance exams. It alleged that two others had already used up eligibility by playing in their home countries over the summer.
Really, if the NCAA had put a microscope on every single program, they would find that other programs were doing the same thing.
Mark says Coach Phillips, the Howard players, and the HBCU community all felt that these rules were being selectively enforced.
And the NCAA, they feel, wanted to send a message to Howard University in particular.
Howard made it back to the national semifinal in 1972. But when the NCAA continued its investigation into the team, Howard voluntarily suspended the players in question right before their match. They played shorthanded against St. Louis and lost 2-1 in overtime. Coach Phillips was 31 years old. He had just finished his third season as Howard's head coach. But at an NCAA-sponsored banquet after the game, he stood up to the organization.
We played against this entire wretched system of this society. Anytime they decide to get together to deprive any people of what is due to them, I would say that the NCAA is guilty of practicing racism.
The place went quiet, and I said to myself, oh my God, what are you saying? What are you going to say after this?
St. Louis did not beat Howard University last night. They beat the remnants. What was left of Howard University.
For those 1971 infractions, the NCAA also suspended Howard from postseason play in 1973. And without a championship to chase, the team struggled to preserve a common identity.
There was a lot of nitpicking and bickering.
They even had little fights that I didn't know about, fist fights.
You have players from all over, each of them different.
The Nigerians, when they speak, It sound as though, you know, hey, you, give me the ball. They don't mean anything. But, you know, the Jamaicans, who you think you're talking to, you know? I'm not going to pass the ball to you.
Howard was postseason eligible again in 1974. And with the season on the horizon, Coach Phillips brought someone in to help reunite his players.
Don Basil Matthews, he was a religious man and educator. And he spoke about this triangle of blackness.
A triangle of blackness.
That's Howard alum Rock Newman.
And that triangle, he said, started in Africa, went to the Caribbean, and got at its furthest point away in America. And they were that link that would link back to Africa with the kind of excellence the whole African diaspora could look on this one team, an example of the best that we can be.
If there was a pivotal moment that led us into 1974, it was that moment. We all started to come together.
They said, in rallying around Coach Lincoln, all right, they took it from us. We got to get it back. Revenge and justice became their calling card after that.
Ian Bain was one of only three players still on the Howard team who had been there in 1971. And under his captainship, The 1974 team put together one of the single greatest seasons in college soccer history. Despite continuing to face racism from many opposing teams, Howard outscored their competition 63-6 and carried a 19-game win streak into the NCAA championship game against none other than St. Louis University. Coach Phillips and members of his team say that the St. Louis players treated them with respect. They knew that they could beat Howard by playing the right way.
There was just so much reward that could come from it, but there was also so much onus that was placed on winning this thing again.
So Mark Wright had this incredible story. He had the funding for an ESPN documentary, but he still didn't have any footage.
Not a good place to start. And in so, and just kind of making connections and telling people, hey, we're working on this project, two former film students at Howard during that time reached out to me, or I connected with them, and they told me that, hey, we have, you know, as part of our films class at Howard back in the day, we used to follow the team around, and we used to capture footage of them playing and training. And so I have some footage somewhere on reel-to-reel tape somewhere in my basement. I haven't seen that stuff in years. It's probably no good. I'm like, get it and give it to me and don't touch it. And I will get it digitized and we'll see what we've got.
Mark got his hands on the tape and sent it to a digitizing house.
And I remember getting that call from the man who owned the shop. And he said, hey, Mark, we've got something here. And I said, turn it up for me. He said, it's not the best quality. It's black and white. It's grainy. I don't even know if you can use it. I'm like, just please just turn it up so I can hear. And what I heard was cheerleaders cheering. I heard somebody giving play-by-play.
It's a cool, bleaky day today here at Busch Stadium in St. Louis for this final of the NCAA for the year 1974.
And that was life-changing for me in the moment. I believed everything Coach told me to that point. I read Coach Lincoln's book, believed it all. But hearing the cheerleaders and seeing the amateur play-by-play, man, get out of here. I mean, that was just transformative for me. You can see from the grainy footage that there's snow that was shoveled up against the embankment. Remember now, these are African players, Caribbean players. These are guys who don't like snow and the cold.
St. Louis looking more aggressive. Kicks a shot. Goal, St. Louis.
We were on the back foot from early. We couldn't get control of the midfield at all, at all, at all.
That's Ian Bain again.
I was having the worst game of my career. I mean, worst. I was expecting Lincoln to take me off at any minute.
We were lucky to have come into the dressing room one goal down.
Coach Phillips kept Ian Bain in the game to start the second half. He also brought in a speedy Jamaican player named Mario McLennan.
That second half gave us some new energy.
And we took over the game.
Head for the Bison's goal. Bison score. Bison score. And the Bisons are back in this ball game.
The two teams played and played and played.
We went into four overtimes, and the overtime period was all ours. The ball hit the upright, the crossbar.
Beautiful shot off the bar, a header taken. It looked like a goal all the way.
It was just a matter of time.
Comes through to Bain, Bain still on the ball. Bain passes it to Davy, Davy on the ball. Davy trying to beat his man down the wing, Davy does. Wings the ball. Goal, Howard. And Howard is the NCAA champs for 1974.
We got it. We got it back. We just didn't win, you know. We took it.
And the crowd on the field goes mad. The Bisons came here to Busch Stadium to take it all, and they have done it.
Mark named his documentary Redemption Song. It premiered at Howard University in April 2016. Players and coaches from the 1970 through 1974 teams came to watch with their family and friends.
For 40-some years, these players have been walking around with a chip on their shoulder, knowing that they went through hell to do something that had never been done. And their story had never been told. Their grandkids don't know. Their kids don't know. They had no link to share. And so this story was redemption. It still means everything to me.
After the screening, Mark had a chance to talk with Coach Ian Bain.
He just said, you know, Mark, I was looking around the room, and I could see guys from that time looking around with pride and saying, I never thought I'd live to see the day where I'd see this story told and my family's here with me. I remember him, you know, giving me the nod and saying, you know, well done. And I, in that moment, I felt like I was 17 again. Because, you know, once you're a player and you have a good relationship with a coach, no matter how old you get, he's still coach and you're still the player.
That story came from Only a Game's Matthew Stock. Special thanks to the folks at ESPN Films for sharing the audio from Redemption Song with us. We'll have a link to the full film on our website. And in case you're wondering what happened with Mark, Coach Bain, and Coach Phillips after the film came out, Mark says they've gotten really close.
I now have them in my life on a regular basis, and I think I'm so much better for it. I'm a better person for it. I'm a better dad for it. I'm sort of a better coach for it. So I'm lucky.
What would you say if you were invited to meet President Barack Obama? Well, if you were former NBA player Jason Collins, you might say this.
I said, yes, Mr. President, you know, I'll be ready. Don't you worry. Look, I will take off my shirt right now and show you my six-pack.
That's just ahead on Only a Game. And you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR.
My darkest past can be a beacon of light for somebody else. I can say, hey, look what I've walked through. You can walk through this too.
Kind World, stories about how profound acts of kindness, big and small, can change lives.
Honestly, the most transformative thing was being treated like a person when I didn't even feel like I was a human.
Our new season starts April 16th with new episodes every Tuesday. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Jason Gay. Next week on Only a Game, what happens when you mix Game of Thrones with NBA drama? I shudder to think. But now, Charlie Pierce is here with the week's news. Hi, Charlie.
Hey, Jason.
This week, the NBA lost a true legend, John Havlicek, the all-time scoring leader of the Boston Celtics, who played 16 seasons spanning from Bob Cousy and Bill Russell to Dave Cowens and JoJo White, and won 8 championships along the way. He also stole a ball. What is Havlicek's mark on the game, and how should he be remembered?
Well, first of all, he should be remembered as one of the great gentlemen who ever played any sport ever. Everyone remembers the Havlicek stole the ball thing. Everybody in New England owned the record album, which was put out with a whole bunch of really great Johnny Most calls of the dynastic Celtics of the 60s. But one of my fondest memories of John Havlicek is his last game at Boston Garden when, you know, it was a terrible Celtics team. It was a Celtics team that won 29 games. And Havlicek couldn't miss and wound up scoring 29 points in his last game.
Well, there's always that conversation, right, about whether or not, you know, players of another generation could fit in with the modern game. And I think a guy like John Havlicek would fit in amazingly on, like, the Golden State Warriors.
Oh, sure. I mean, the constant motion, the moving without the ball, the incredible stamina the guy had. I think certainly in a system like that or a system like the Spurs, he would prosper.
All right, elsewhere, Charlie, we saw the defending Stanley Cup champion, Washington Capitals, bounce from the playoffs in the first round after Carolina took Game 7 in a thrilling double overtime win. Hockey's top teams are dropping like flies. Every division leader is now out. Is this bad, or is chaos part of what makes the Stanley Cup playoffs so compelling?
Well, chaos is always what has made the playoffs compelling. There's a unique amount of it this year, as you pointed out. Every hockey fan's going to have to learn a bunch of new names now. I mean, they're going to have to learn who plays for the Columbus Blue Jackets to start with.
On Thursday, Charlie, the Arizona Cardinals used the first pick in the NFL draft to select quarterback Kyler Murray, who seems poised now to replace former Arizona Cardinals first-round pick Josh Rosen, who the team took last year. Why are the Cardinals making such an awkward move?
Because Josh Rosen apparently did not work out the way they thought, and because they brought in Cliff Kingsbury, a former quarterback himself, specifically to coach Murray, or at least that's what the perception around the league is. So they're going to, you know, they've rolled the dice now 2 years in a row. So we'll see. I mean, with any luck, they'll be able to get something for Josh Rosen.
Yeah, they have to trade him, right?
I would think, but who knows?
I saw this great comment from the Athletic's Nicole Auerbach the other night. She said, "I am very prepared for a world in which the New England Patriots trade a fifth-round pick for Josh Rosen and he becomes a Hall of Famer." Is that in play?
Well, I don't know. I mean, the previous precedent is to find a college player that, you know, is a sixth-round draft pick or something and then make them into a Hall of Famer. But I assume they could adjust the process. Of course, the problem they have is that apparently every time they draft or bring in a new quarterback, Tom Brady gets mad.
Yeah.
I mean, he's perfectly content to have Brian Hoyer have a 19-year NFL career.
Totally unrelated to this, news arrived at the end of the week that Clemson University is on the verge of awarding Coach Dabo Swinney a $93 million contract over 10 years. That number, that's just spectacular, is it not?
Well, you know, let's say it all together. There's never enough money, which is what you hear every time somebody suggests that the players should share in all of this. You know, there's never enough money to do that, but there's enough money to throw $93 million at Dabo Swinney, which undoubtedly makes him the richest Dabo in the world. I haven't done the research, but I'm sure it does.
Yeah, I don't even need to fact check it. All right, WNBA, new TV deal with CBS, which is going to broadcast 40 WNBA games this season. ABC, ESPN, and Twitter are also carrying WNBA games. What does this latest deal say about the league's growth?
Well, it says that network executives, you know, see it as, at the very least, compelling summer programming, and at the very most, a league on the rise. And I think they're right to do so. I don't know exactly how you watch a game on Twitter. I mean, every play can only be 280 characters. I mean, they dribble the ball 281 times and everybody stops.
Sliding over to the NBA, I have to ask you what you thought about this.
Lillard, long range three, and it's good at the buzzer! Damian Lillard, are you kidding me? A 37-foot dagger. Oh, my.
That was Damian Lillard's 37-foot buzzer beater, not a misprint. 37 feet to send the OKC Thunder packing in the NBA playoffs. Best game ending or series ending shot you've seen, Charlie? You've seen a few.
I'll tell you, best one I've seen in a long time. And the great thing about it was actually a shot. I mean, it's a jump shot. It's exactly the same form you would see on a 12-foot jump shot.
And finally, Charlie, regardless of how far Golden State goes in the playoffs, the New York Times had a great piece with Steph Curry. It turns out Curry has given NBA fans everywhere some very important service journalism. And what is this?
Well, Steph Curry has decided to rank all the popcorn in the arenas around the NBA. Now, this comes as some shock to me because I thought all NBA arenas got their popcorn from the same place.
Yeah, right.
Which is, you know, indigestible foods of, you know, Knoxville, Tennessee or someplace. But no, he claims he can judge them. And right now he puts American Airlines Arena in Dallas at the top of his survey.
So he didn't put his own arena's popcorn first?
He says Dallas gets 5 out of 5, the only one that gives it a 5 out of 5.
Wow. He's going to get some dirty looks around Oracle Arena.
Well, until he hits about 9 jump shots in a row, and then everything will be fine again.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce at Sports Illustrated, and he joins us each week here at Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Jason.
Turns out you're never too old to run for president. That's also true for subscribing to the Only a Game podcast at Apple, Stitcher, or whatever else the kids these days are using. Feel the burn of exciting new sports stories every week. And don't forget to cast your vote for Only a Game by leaving us a review. Are you ready? Because this next story is going to transport you all the way back to the year 2014. Yeah, it was a simpler time when transgender people were not banned from serving in the U.S. military, and the New York Times bestseller list did not include a book about a president cheating at golf. Here's Only a Game's Karen Given.
We do a lot of research before we interview people for Only a Game, so it's not actually all that unusual for a question we ask to get a response like this.
Wow, you really have done your homework about me. I love this. Okay. So,
Jason Collins was the first openly gay male in one of this country's four major sports, assuming that you count hockey and not soccer as number four. He was sitting in a studio in L.A. We'd been talking for an hour, and he was thirsty.
Let me get a sip of water before I start this one. So, I got asked in January of 2014 to attend the State of the Union and sit as a guest in the First Lady's viewing box.
2014. Barack Obama was president. His wife, Michelle, was the First Lady. Collins was allowed to bring one guest. He chose his twin brother, Jaron, who had also played in the NBA for many years.
And I've been to the White House before, but, you know, you take the tour, you're not allowed to touch anything, really. And I'll never forget being in the Blue Room, which sits directly in line with the Washington Monument, and sitting down in a chair with my brother, having a glass of wine, and just looking out like, wow, this is where we are right now.
It's a beautiful moment of gratitude when you think about it. Collins was deep into a journeyman's career and a free agent when he announced that he was gay in April of 2013. And by January of 2014, he was still without a job. Some predicted that no NBA team would sign an openly gay player who had never been a star and was, frankly, getting old. But Collins wasn't thinking about any of that while sipping wine in the Blue Room with his brother, nor was he thinking about it later that night when he was watching the State of the Union address with Michelle Obama.
Mr. Speaker, Mr. Vice President, members of Congress, my fellow Americans.
If we could just fast forward a bit.
Because we believe in the inherent dignity and equality of every human being, regardless of race or religion, creed or sexual orientation.
Remember what it was like to have a president who said things like that? Anyway, after the speech, protocol requires the guests of the First Lady to line up for an official meet and greet with the president. Jason Collins waited in line, and soon enough, it was his turn.
We shake hands and then do the picture. And then I turn back to the president, and he says, you know, just remember, he knows basketball. He said, just remember, after the trade deadline, that's when a lot of free agents get picked up.
The NBA trade deadline was a little more than 3 weeks away. Collins had been working out a lot. He says he was in great shape, and he wanted the president to know it.
I said, yes, Mr. President, you know, I'll be ready. Don't you worry. And I said to him, like, look, I will, you know, take off my shirt right now and show you my six-pack, but the First Lady was like 5 feet away, and then also obviously the Secret Service guards were all right there. So, and I said, I don't think it'd be a good idea for me to take my shirt off and show you my six-pack right now. And then he looked at me and he like sort of nodded his head. He's like, yeah, that's a good idea. You should keep your shirt on.
Jason Collins kept his shirt on, and sure enough, 3 days after the trade deadline, he was signed to a 10-day contract. Hours after that happened, reporters crammed into an interview room to question the newest member of the Brooklyn Nets.
Jason, when you first learned that the Nets were going to sign you, can you just describe what went through your mind?
Well, I first found out this morning. Woke up around 8:15, had a couple missed calls.
Jason Collins didn't say that he figured the call was coming because the leader of the free world had predicted almost to the day when it would come. But he could have.
That's Only a Game's Karen Given, speaking to former NBA player Jason Collins. Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallach, with help from Nico Emack and Matthew Stock. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our senior producer is Karen Given. I'm Jason Gay. Only a Game returns next week. Thanks for listening.